Okay, we'll bring the meeting of Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance to order. You want to have a quorum. Apologize to those of the public that you can't get started because it takes us a while. The members all straggle in. The first bill today would be House File 2774, Representative Fenton. Any amendments?
We got a quorum.
Representative Fenton, Chair will move House File 30. What? Oh, that's right. We can't move it until we get enough people here. So if you would like, go ahead, and I'll probably have to rudely interrupt you when we get a quorum and have you stop just for a second while we do the other business. So go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 2774 be passed on to the General Register. Members, this is House File 2774 basically is a bill that requires the Secretary of State to develop a statewide plan to address emergencies that may disrupt an election and requires for each county to develop a similar plan. This bill came as a result of a task force, a bipartisan task force that we served on this year that had members from the Senate, members from the House. It had military members, it had members that serve as the county election officials, as well as a member from Homeland Security. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier, Secretary Steve Simon. Thank you.
Good to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Go ahead with your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Steve Simon, Secretary of State. Great to be with you, especially since I served on this committee alongside many of you for a number of years. So.
There we go.
Good to be back. Thank you. I know you got a lot going on, so I'll try to be quick. As Representative Fenton said, this is the result of the Elections Emergency Planning Task Force, and if I had to kind of trace it to anything, it would be Hurricane Sandy in 2012. Some of you members remember that in 2012, just a couple of days or so before the general election, also a presidential election, Hurricane Sandy hit the shores of New York and New Jersey, and it caused considerable chaos and questions. At the time, if you remember, there was news coverage about whether in some places in New York and New Jersey they were going to have to postpone the election. That didn't end up happening. But it caused those states to look inward, look at their law books, and see, well, what guidance was there, if any, about what to do in the case of an emergency that impacts an election? What was on the menu? What could they really do? And the answer was they really didn't know. In the end, it turned out okay. No one had to postpone. Things went off pretty much without a hitch. But that caused a lot of other states, including ours, to look at our own law books and determine what guidance, if any, we had for what would happen in that situation. And the answer in Minnesota is really not very much. We have some very limited guidance in terms of what's on the menu, what the options are. So the legislature last year passed this provision calling for an Elections Emergency Planning Task Force. I ended up chairing it. As Representative Fenton said, we had 14 members. We had members from all four legislative caucuses. Interestingly, we had emergency management folks from multiple layers. We had the director of Minnesota Homeland Security and Emergency Management. We had an emergency manager serving in the National Guard. And then third, we had a representative of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers. And these were folks who were not elections experts, but they were emergency management experts. We also had election experts from the township, county, and state level as well. And basically, the idea was to recommend material to put in our laws to ensure that we at least had some rules of the road, that if we had something happen on an emergency basis, we knew where to go. We're not going to have a hurricane, obviously, in Minnesota, but we might have a Halloween-style snowstorm like we did in 1991, or we might have a public health outbreak. You never know. Even if it's a remote possibility, we have to plan for that stuff and have things on the books. So we heard a lot of testimony from state experts, national experts, and a couple of bills came out of that process. The one before you is the first one. So House File 2774, as Representative Fenton said, and she, by the way, served on the task force, it recommended really three things. First, it requires the Office of Secretary of State to create a state elections emergency plan. And the plan would be created in consultation with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, Division of Homeland Security, and Emergency Management. I think that's why it's before you, Mr. Chair. Second, it would require the Office of Secretary of State to develop a model emergency plan for counties, kind of a template that they could use and cut and paste. They could take some of it, all of it, none of it, but it would at least be a template, a model for them to use for their own plans. And then third, it would require each county to create a local elections emergency plan for use in all elections within the county. And again, they have to consult with cities, towns, school districts, and their local emergency management folks. I've talked with and met with, in their offices, probably two-thirds of the elections administrators in the counties, and they all, without any dissent, support this, as long as they have that template. As long as our office comes forward with kind of the model that they can cut and paste from, they're okay with this. And it doesn't have to be hundreds of pages. It doesn't even have to be dozens of pages. It's just something that, you know, sets out some rules of the road about what would happen. It's basically a continuity of operations plan. So we're not creating or authorizing any new emergency powers in this bill. Nothing changes from current law. It's just about the planning piece and making sure there are plans in place at the state level, at the county level, with assistance from our office, using a template that they can cut and paste. So that's really the bill, Mr. Chair and members, and I'm happy to stand for questions or take any comments that you have.
Okay, members, any question on Representative Fenton's bill? Representative Considine.
I believe we have a quorum now. We could probably officially.
Yeah, I'm just going to get to that. Representative Quam, and then I'll we'll bring the meeting officially to order and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine?
Here.
Representative Dean?
Here.
Representative Flanagan? Representative Hertas?
Late, but here.
Representative Hillstrom? Representative Howe?
Here.
Representative Lohmer? Representative Lucero?
Here.
Representative Neuberger? Representative O'Neill?
Here.
Representative Quam?
Present.
Representative Rosenthal?
Here.
Representative Schoen?
Here.
Representative Ward? And Representative Zerwas?
Here.
Okay, thank you, Representative Considine. And then approval of minutes for March 29th. Who would like to move the minutes? Representative Schoen.
Glad to be here.
Moves the minutes for March 29th. If no additions or corrections, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, now I'll go back to the bill. The chair will move House File 2774 to be referred to the General Register. And Representative Quam, did you have a question? There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary of State Simons, when you did the review, did you go over the possibility there could be difficulties with documentation and other record keeping? And did the group discuss the possibility of actually conforming to HAVA and not being one of, you know, a very small group of states that don't have provisional ballots in case there's difficulties with identity?
Simon.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Representative Quam, it really was a thorough and comprehensive discussion about exactly that issue, about ballots and what you do with ballot security. If, for example, and this has happened in other states, if you have a facility, a polling place that's flooded, or the power goes out, or there's a bomb threat, let's say, in a polling place, and you have to evacuate it for a number of hours and then come back, what do you do with those ballots? I have to say, provisional balloting, that particular issue, if it came up, it was probably briefly, I would say. We were really focused on ballot security and what do you do if you have to leave, whether it's for an hour or 10 hours or permanently, I guess, and if you have to move a polling place in the middle of. That's really what we focused on, and that's what this bill is focused on, really, is the really nitty-gritty sort of logistical issues of what do you do if an emergency hits, certainly during election, like on election day. But even in advance, even a few days in advance, you know, what do you do maintaining that sort of ballot security? So the provisional ballot issue, which is, you know, a hot live issue, I would say, didn't so much come up in the context of this bill and these very kind of logistical concerns, I would say.
Mr. Chair.
Wrong follow-up.
Yes. I guess I would assume if there was, you know, flood, disaster, that it would be conceivable that with our same-day registration and stuff, people would not have the opportunity, or maybe there was destroyed whatever document they would need to bring in to verify, and there being another state with same-day registration that does have provisional, so they guarantee anyone that shows up gets to cast a ballot. I would have hoped that this group would have looked at it, especially considering 97% of all people that live in the United States District of Columbia, et cetera, have that protection that if they show up, they get to cast a ballot. If there's any, you know, issue of not having documentation, you know, then it becomes provisional. I would hope that, as you said, there were other bills and further work, you would look at trying to bring us into federal compliance with HAVA and, you know, bring forth, like, almost every other state, including the District of Columbia, have done compliance-wise with the provisional ballot guaranteeing accessibility to cast a ballot. Thank you.
Okay, why haven't we voted on this bill yet? Go ahead, Representative Considine.
I just want to know what HAVA is. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
What?
HAVA?
Help America Vote Act.
Okay, there it is.
There it is. Thanks.
All right.
I share your concern.
Any other questions? Any other testimony from the audience? Seeing none. Any closing statement to either Secretary Simon or?
I just want to thank the committee, so thank you.
And thanks for coming down, Secretary.
Thank you.
The chair will renew his motion for House File 2774 to be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you much.
Thank you, members.
House File 3333, Representative Barrett. Chair will move House File 3333 to be referred to the General Register. Representative Barrett, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3333 updates the schedule of controlled substances in Chapter 152. I have with me Dr. Cody Weiberg from the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. The Board of Pharmacy is actually required yearly to send a letter to the legislature letting them know what new drugs are out there that need to be added to the schedules. This bill right here is a byproduct of that report. We're adding 14 synthetic drugs to Schedule 1. All of these are either cannabinoids, hallucinogens, stimulants, or CNS depressants, and there's also one being added to Schedule 4. As I mentioned, Dr. Cody Weiberg is here to go over the bill and answer any questions.
Good to have you back, sir. Mm-hmm. Your name and title and begin.
Oh, yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. I actually don't have that much to add unless there are questions. The board is required to submit a report to the legislature every year about drugs actually that we have put into the schedules through rulemaking. We did not do that this year, but the 14 drugs that are being added to, we're proposing to add to Schedule 1 have all been reported to us by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension or various law enforcement agencies as being actually found in the state, usually seized as part of a criminal investigation. There's one drug in Schedule 4 that's actually has legitimate medical purposes, but the federal government has already put that drug into Schedule 4 as well, so this just conforms the state schedule to the federal schedule for that one drug.
Okay, thank you, sir. Any questions? Seeing none, any closing statement?
Thank you very much.
All right. The chair will renew his motion for House File 3333 to refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Representative Anderson, House File 3469. Representative Anderson, the chair will move House File 3469 to be referred to the General Register. And you have testifiers with no amendments? Okay, you go ahead and begin.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good morning. Yes, I do have one small oral amendment, if I could offer it, Mr. Chair. Your research staff noticed that on page line 1.8, subdivision 2 should read subdivision 1.1a. I could make that oral amendment.
Any objections to that amendment? All right. The staff has it. Chair will move that amendment as stated. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. We're here with this bill is a result of a tragic incident that happened back up in Douglas County last fall. It received a lot of coverage in the media. Again, a tragic incident where a young lady disappeared the night of October 14th. She was last seen on a surveillance camera at a gas station. And her body was recovered or found 12 days later in a cornfield in rural Douglas County. And I can only imagine what her family went through those 12 days of living hell of not knowing what happened to their daughter, if she was alive, or as the days went on, if they would find her. And the case was finally resolved, and the family and residents were surprised or shocked at the sentence that we perceive as being much not severe enough for what happened in this case. And I have with me the county attorney in Douglas County, and he can give you a rundown of that side of the case and to tell you what happened, how the case was determined and decided, and talk about the penalty. And what the bill does is just change a gross misdemeanor, which is what happened in this case, for hiding a body, lying to the coroner, and changing it to a felony is what this bill does. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to introduce the attorney, county attorney in Douglas County.
Please state your name and title, sir, and begin.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chad Larson. I'm Douglas County attorney. And I'm here as a result of the Schwendeman case. I don't think that this is an isolated incident that we're asking you to enact legislation for. I think that this happens with some fair frequency throughout the nation. As a county attorney, and more particularly as a prosecutor, it's my duty to try to strive for justice to the best I can using the tools that you've enabled me with. And in this case, the tools just aren't there. Laura was 18 years old. She was riding with a friend of hers in a vehicle. It appears that they were doing methamphetamine together. At some point on the night of the 14th, she, according to her companion and the defendant in the case, had overdosed on methamphetamine. He took her body, he drug it out 18 rows into a cornfield and left her there. He returned to his car, he drove back to his dealer, he got more methamphetamine and shot up. He then took the rest of Laura's personal property, drove to Laura's parents' house, and greeted them and said, "Here's her stuff." And they said, "Well, where's Laura?" And he said, "I don't know." And he left. Throughout the course of approximately 5 or 6 interviews that law enforcement had while Laura was missing, the defendant maintained that he took some methamphetamine, he blacked out, he didn't know what happened. He put our law enforcement on a wild goose chase. He was drawing them away from where he dumped her body by dropping hints. So he remembers something about Kensington or something, luring them away. In the meantime, the community in Douglas County was fearful that perhaps we had a murderer loose. There were rumors. We had volunteer community members, the sheriff's office, a number of law enforcement agencies assisting us in trying to locate her body. In the meantime, the defendant sat back and watched this all occur. It was only because of two farmers on October 26th who were combining that happened to notice her body. And Laura was found. The officers went back to the defendant, and we had one veteran BCA agent and a rookie deputy. The veteran BCA agent could not, even with having her body been found, elicit some sort of admission from her. It was only after our rookie detective said, "You know, I really think there's something you want to tell us. You look like you're hurting, and it's going to be a big relief if you just tell us what happened." And at that point, he broke down, and he said he became frightened because she died in his car. He didn't want to be blamed for this. And so he dumped her body and watched the rest of the community try to find her. Unfortunately, he wasn't aware of the Good Samaritan law that the legislature had passed recently, which would have provided him immunity in the situation where two people are injecting methamphetamine together and one overdoses. if the other calls for emergency help, there's immunity for any methamphetamine or controlled substances that are found with them. I think that this bill allows myself and other prosecutors to more effectively address situations in which people are concealing evidence, tampering with evidence, hiding bodies. It also provides for restitution. Our law enforcement incurred over $20,000 in trying to locate Ms. Schwendeman, which I'm still having to litigate in the criminal case in terms of trying to get that recovered. It also expands the prior version of 609-502, which references merely a coroner. So it provides felony penalty for concealing a body, concealing evidence, or otherwise misleading the coroner or medical examiner. And I think the medical examiner reference is necessary in that medical examiners are now forensically trained, whereas coroners aren't. So counties have medical examiners at this point. I can tell you finally that this isn't something new. Arizona has already made this crime a felony. Wisconsin has made this crime a felony. Oklahoma has it on the books as a felony. There's a bill, my understanding, in Colorado introduced in the Senate, which would make it a felony. And New York, in last year, made tampering with a body a felony. I think it's very important. I would ask that that this committee consider that. Thank you.
Okay. Do you have another testifier?
No, I do not.
Okay. Questions from members? Representative Dean and then Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a few questions, and I'm not sure how they're going to be perceived, but you know, you talked about if the individual would have known about the Good Samaritan law, it would have been a totally different situation. And ultimately, what we're now trying to do is we're changing a crime that for this individual was probably a panic crime from a gross misdemeanor to a felony. What is truly the intent of changing it to a felony? Because deterrence is not an issue for these given situations. And ultimately, is this really to begin to place harsher punishment on the individual? And the reason that I ask this is we're going to change this law, I'm assuming, from a gross misdemeanor to a felony. And there's going to be people out there that are in situations that oftentimes involve overdoses of friends and colleagues, may not know about the Good Samaritan law. They're going to panic. They're going to do things to try to conceal what had happened. And ultimately now we're taking that and we're saying that we're going to charge you with a felony, and we're also going to possibly fine you up to $20,000. And I guess my question to the prosecutor is, if after the first day or two, if this individual would have said what happened, that would have changed the situation greatly for the family. It would have probably changed the situation greatly for all the investigators in the community that was looking for this individual's body. And for that matter, it could be that same day. And I'm trying to understand why changing this from a gross misdemeanor to a felony helps public safety in any way possible.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sentencing serves a number of purposes, and one is deterrence, another is a punishment. And I think that in this case, elevating this crime from a gross misdemeanor to a felony will have a deterrent effect. I do think that it also allows the punishment to fit the crime. I think that callously dumping a human body in a cornfield for selfish purposes, the same as if somebody dismembers a body and conceals it, I don't think that a gross misdemeanor adequately reflects that act. And as far as the Good Samaritan law, I don't know that that would have made a difference, because whether he was aware of it or not, I don't know that he cared. I think he was acting very selfishly. And so I think this law also addresses that, in that if you're dealing with people who act in the state of selfishness, they're also going to be concerned about the consequences of their acts. And in this case, if the consequences is merely a misdemeanor or gross misdemeanor, that's where I think they could have a deterrent effect. Secondly, as the committee is probably aware, the penalty provisions in a criminal statute are the maximums, and nobody will ever receive a $20,000 fine for something like this. I think the sentencing guidelines would also have to attach a severity level to this offense, so that it would fall within the sentencing guidelines grid. And as to whether that would be a presumptive commit for this type of offense or not, I don't know where that would fall. And so I think this happens with enough frequency that the legislature should address it. I think it should be a felony, but I don't think it happens with enough frequency that we're going to see a large fiscal impact in terms of the costs associated with incarceration.
Representative Dean, follow up.
So you said this happens with enough frequency. How much frequency? 5 times a year, 25 times a year, 100 times a year? I'm curious what you mean.
I can only speak from my personal. I dealt with it twice last year, and not once in the 16 years prior to that as a prosecutor. And only tangentially in the first time in that part of the offense occurred in my community. And then secondly was with the Schwendeman case. But I think as we see nationwide that this is a problem that a lot of states are addressing, and I think we should take a good look at it also.
Just a quick statement. For drug addicts that are committing crimes, the last thing they're thinking about is what's the possible charge I could have and what my sentence would be. So I would disagree with you that for many individuals, deterrence is actually a motivator to not commit a crime. I think that quite often where drug use is involved, it's sort of the last thing an individual thinks about is what's going to be my consequence of the crime. Now, someone who's not under the influence, that might actually have a role, but I think for individuals that are chronic drug users or under the influence, I think that that's probably 25 on their list of things to consider when they make choices and the things they do, and I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
A representative shown to this point, and while Representative Schoen asked the question, look through your packets, if you would, folks. There's letters from the family on there. But go ahead, Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Chair Cornish. Representative Dean, I think as the chief author of Steve's law that we passed in this House to provide that immunity, I think it's great. That is clear. I think clearly the point of that we want that to be out there, and that people do know that there are consequences, and the reason that they do know is that they because we didn't want them to discard human beings like they were common trash. And that was exactly what happened here. And I, you know, it's one of the things that I think maybe he didn't highlight is if I'm the investigator and have been in cases related to homicide or death, and is a tool for me to bring closure to the family. And that hammer of a felony, like it or not, in this case, you know, I'm gonna be on the side of us doing more things to treat people with chemical dependency and lower those penalties. And not, you know, I'm on that side. I think we can do better for those folks that are being incarcerated and that aren't being treated. But in this particular circumstance, once you've crossed that threshold of discarding another human being like a common bag of trash, I've lost it. You know, I don't have it for you as quite as much as I did before. I understand probably the concept of where you're coming from. I just don't think that in this particular circumstance that I probably could be as sympathetic to that person. I don't know if that makes sense to the other individual. I mean, that's what I feel like I'm hearing. So I think that one, but I just want to say that that felony in this particular circumstance, if I'm the investigator and I'm working with the BCA and Drew, we need to be able to have that hammer to go, listen, you know, because the county attorney has the ability to say, you know, I won't prosecute you for this crime today. We can make a deal if you tell me where she is today. He has that opportunity, but can't do that if it's a gross misdemeanor and he knows there's no consequences. So I think this is a very worthy change in statute.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. Quickly.
I'll just leave you with one thought. In this case, and I think it's the most telling as to why we need to change this statute, this particular defendant was in jail for this offense, waiting for the outcome. And while he was in jail, he became upset, and he took a lunch tray, a plastic lunch tray, and he threw it at a window. He broke the jail window. That, ladies and gentlemen, was a felony crime. And dumping her body was not, because the replacement cost of that window in the jail was over $1,000. That's wrong.
Thank you, sir. Representative O'Neill. And then Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick kind of technical question for staff. Because we're changing this to a felony, could staff let us know kind of where on the grid this lies? If, you know, if it's the maximum of 10 years and $20,000, is there a mandatory minimum in this? I don't know where we're putting this in section of law. I just kind of want to understand where it's at.
Mr. Chair and members, the sentencing guidelines would need to rank this offense. When I was looking at the sentencing guidelines for other 10-year felonies, criminal vehicular homicide is a 10-year felony, and that is ranked as an 8, which is a 48-month commit. But there are other 10-year felonies that are similar to this crime, like concealing criminal proceeds, and that's unranked. And in that case, the judge would decide the severity level. So I can't really give you a great answer, but hopefully that's some guidance. But the 10-year is the maximum.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my opinion is the most important thing in this particular case is having the family get closure and for them to find out what happened to their daughter. We did have a similar case in Blue Earth County where a girl took too many drugs, wandered out into a field, face down in the mud. But this is really horrific, but I think that we have a tendency to overreact to horrific incidents, and 10 years from now people are going to go, what were they thinking when they made it a felony and we have people in jail or county attorneys using it as the main charge in something where they have something smaller. And I just feel like it's an overreaction, and I guess I can't support it because of that.
Okay. Anybody else? Any questions? Okay. Anybody else to testify? Seeing none, I will renew the motion for Representative Anderson's bill, House File 3469, as amended to be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much, folks. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson, House File 3423. Representative Johnson, you can move your bill first, and then I understand you have an amendment.
Mr. Chair, where is this bill going from here?
GovOps.
Mr. Chair, I make a motion that House File 3423 be passed and moved to government operation.
Okay, and Representative Johnson moved 3423 to refer to government ops. And with that, you want to move your amendment?
Yes, I have the amendment, the A160959, which would put it in line with the Senate version.
Representative Johnson moves that amendment to authorize the amendment to get the shape he would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, to your bill, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill deals with both the juvenile and the criminal information policy task force that was put in statute a number of years ago. Between September and March of 2014 and March 2015, the group was meeting regularly to discuss the next phases of both the committees, or the task forces, and they came up with a new strategic plan how to help with not only with the legislature of the issues, but also with the governor's office and the Supreme Court. They deal with all those issues. And the recommendation by both the committees was to merge into one committee. Most of the vast majority of the members on both committees are the same members. So they're talking about the same issues, and instead of meeting twice discussing the same issues, I think it'd be more efficient to just meet one time dealing with the same issues. And but today I have with me from the BCA, Drew Evans, who is going to explain the bill.
Go ahead, sir. Your name and title.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Drew Evans. I am the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Representative Johnson outlined that for you that this was part of a strategic planning process. These two committees were statutorily authorized, and in statute they've been meeting since 1993, so this is a long-standing group. Part of that strategic planning process is that they determine they've met many of their legislatively mandated priorities between these two groups. And so almost overwhelmingly, these two groups voted to merge into one advisory group. They feel it's important to continue having an advisory group to advise both you as a legislature, the governor's office, Supreme Court, and us as the BCA, working on criminal justice information initiatives that move through all of those groups as you're going from there. The current makeup, just to highlight for all of you, of the groups would remain largely unchanged. As Representative Johnson noted, the main changes would be that there were a redundancy between commissioners on one group and then their delegate or themselves on the second group. It would just be their same representation on the one group. In addition, we met with the judicial branch that indicated they could accomplish their same goals with three members as opposed to the six that they currently have. Just to highlight for the group what they would continue to examine are data practices, and as Representative Johnson, it was amended to include data practices and individual privacy rights and data on race and ethnicity, information sharing at the local and state and federal levels, technology education and innovation, impact of proposed legislation on the criminal justice system related to information systems and business processes, and data and identification standards. This group could be required to continue to file a biennial report that goes to the chairs of the committees that have oversight of these issues, both here in the House and in the Senate, and would require, as said in this, that any funding that may go to this group would be reviewed by this group going forward, staying in line with the same practices for any funding that may be appropriated to any of these groups. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Members, questions? Seeing none, any questions in the audience? Any closing statements, Representative Johnson?
Members, Mr. Chair, I think this bill does a good thing. It ends some of the redundancy of the things that are going on, and I'd ask your support.
Okay, thank you, Representative Johnson. You can move your bill as amended. As amended.
Mr. Chair, I renew my motion to on Bill 3546 to move forward to government, refer to government operations as amended.
Okay, Representative Johnson, actually it's House File
3423.
33 is amended. Okay, and to governance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you, Representative Johnson. Okay, House File 3546. Representative Johnson, would you like to move your bill?
This going to government office as well, sir?
General Registration.
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move House File 3546 to the General Register.
Okay, your bill being moved, you have an author's amendment to A1. You'd like to move that?
Yes, I would like to move the A1 amendment to get in the form that I so desire.
Okay, without objection, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, to your bill as amended, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill deals with the county probation officers, or should be the community probation officers. Right now, we have a three-tier system that's set up between CPO, CPA, and I believe the other one is the DOC. This change is just basically, except for the amendment, just a couple minor word change. One of the changes is changing it to a may. Basically, they may provide adult felony supervision. Right now, they do not by statute. The unfortunate problem is sometimes due to the backlog and requests for court dates to be moved up for expediency purposes, there's times that the people that are supposed to be doing these duties do not have time to do them, and the community, the CPOs are then asked to step in and fulfill those duties. Unfortunately, our current law does not allow that. So this bill just basically getting set up so if needed and if they choose, they may provide some of the services. They're not trying to take over any of the services, but they, when they're asked to do some of these services, they want to fall in line and not be in violation of the current law. And with that, I'll leave it up to the testifiers.
Okay, sir, go ahead and your name and title and begin.
My name is Tim McMillan, and I'm Isani County Probation Director, and I've been in corrections for 20 years. Mr. Chair and members of the House Public Safety Committee, I want to thank you for your time and hearing my testimony. As a person supporting the small but impactful language change to House Bill 3546, this language change is a win-win for all three delivery systems. The following points are reasons why we think this language will have an impact on offender accountability, better outcomes for offenders, and increased public safety. This language change is not about taking away from our current three delivery system model, but adding to the ability of counties to have a choice and work with DOC on providing felony level services in local communities. The language change is about giving all counties options. Talking point number one. Currently, counties that fall under 244.19 provide pretrial services on felony-level offenders that are ordered to have conditions of release before their release from local county jails. We in the CPO world believe that building rapport and establishing a connection with offenders before they are released into the community or before they are sentenced on their post-sentence is important to providing rapport with offenders and building relationships and providing better outcomes for offenders. That's what these current pretrial felony services do that are being offered in CPO counties. These felony pretrial services provide access to rehabilitation services quicker and can reduce caseloads. In many rural areas, the ability of CPO agents to provide felony supervision will only enhance the efficiency of a service and accountability. For example, county-run specific programming like intensive DWI programs, veteran courts, and drug courts are some of the things that current CPO counties do and would love to supervise those felony offenders that could also become part of that as part of this law change. This change in law will add to better policy and decisions that reduce recidivism and provide better outcomes for public safety. It allows the courts and probation directors to tailor services that would allow felony offenders to take part in programming that is already being provided by some of the CPO-run counties. Quicker and faster, more accountability times, less wait time to get into programming is something that CPO strides itself on. Low felony offenders who may get placed on a lower risk caseload would be able to take advantage of specific county run programming. For example, specific cognitive programming like driving with care and other evidence-based curriculums. In 2014, the adult felony population in Minnesota was 45,581 offenders. In 2008, it was reported out that probation officers had caseloads three times greater than what they had in 1980. We believe there is some room and cost savings for DOC to work with CPO counties to reduce DOC caseloads where CPO counties can work with felony offenders. Thank you.
Is there your name and organization?
Mike McMillan. I'm the director of Wright County Court Services, which offers probation services to our county. I'm not going to repeat the things my esteemed colleague and younger brother said, but in our county, we're actually doing the services that he talked about. We're a large CPO county, approximately 130,000, and currently we're doing pretrial services for the court and the county. We work in unison with the DOC. We're also providing other types of programming, you know, for the bench and for our county. And one of those things that we're now exploring is drug court. You know, the word may is really important for us, really important for our bench, that would give us the flexibility to do some of the things we're already doing and work a little bit closer with them. And I don't see it as anything other than a win-win for everybody involved in the three delivery systems. You know, the amendment will speak to, or did speak to, employees coming over into the CPO world, if in fact that would happen. That's not necessarily anticipation, but that also needed to be addressed, and that's why the amendment was proposed.
Okay, folks, any questions? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want a clarification on the cost. I hear from my counties they're really concerned about any shift in cost to the counties. So just so that I understand what you're talking about, if these employees change, will there be an additional cost, and who's going to pay for it?
Well, I want to go back to the May first. So May provide those services. If there is a shift in cost, I mean, if there's a shift in employees, I wouldn't see that there be a shift in any cost that they're already existing, because they're already current employees. Those employees would shift over. So if there was a full swing shift, if a county decided to go that direction, under the current statute, we get a portion of our salaries and fringe paid, what's under called the CPO reimbursement. So that money would, I would assume, come over, but that money is currently sitting there in field services budget. So I wouldn't see it as any additional cost to the county. Or it's one they would choose to make as well. They still have that choice.
Okay. Our Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, that's why the key word in there is may. It'd be the county's choice is what they would want to do. If they would want to do this, they know that it would be at their cost. We're not forcing them to do it. It's an option that they have.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to have you here. I didn't realize you guys are brothers. That's great. So can you just speak a little bit more about how this change would help Wright County, in particular, as we're moving forward with the drug court? Just help me understand the shift of responsibility from the state to the county and how that makes this transition a little bit easier to do a drug court in Wright County.
Well, for us, it's a word shift. So it would clearly define that we would have that, the court would have that ability to direct us to do those types of services. So right now, where we are doing them, it's kind of a gray area. Who does them? It's kind of like, okay, you do it, I do it. There's not really anything set in stone that delineates that. And I think it would just, for us, it would clean things up a lot. And there would be no cost to that.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what this would do right now, where the current law is, a Department of Corrections would have to supervise the person in that drug court, even though it's a county-run base and the county probation's set up on the CPO. With this law, the county probation, you know, the CPOs could actually work with it, with the other ones, and understand the programs better.
Mr. Chair, may I have a follow-up?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and a more global question, maybe this is for the esteemed representative. So have you looked at, say, Ramsey County, Hennepin County, other counties that are doing drug court or any of the other specialty courts, and how are they operating, and do they have conflict with DOC when they're working on this, or do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative, to be honest, I have not looked at that issue.
I can take it, Representative O'Neill. The two you mentioned are
go through the chair.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair.
That's okay.
If pleases the chair, I can answer the question.
Right.
Okay. Those counties, the two you mentioned, are CCA counties, so the Community Corrections Act counties, so they have the authority to do that. In the counties, the analysis we've done, we've looked at lots of different counties, and they're kind of all over the map and how specialty courts are done. I'll just use the word specialty court versus drug court.
Right.
So they're done different ways, different places, with different levels of offenders, and this would just give, I think just clarifies the ability to do it a little cleaner for a bench and for a county.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, questions? Public testimony. Again, we stand at least one.
Mr. Chair and members, Richard Kajewski, the Public Affairs and Communications Director for MAPE. In my capacity, I also represent all of the state probation officers. This is a significant change to the three delivery system model that's before you. I understand that the language is a change in the word may. Not only do they not follow the 30,000 minimum population, but this creates an ongoing interchangeable system with what you just passed with CCA for CCA counties last week. And more so, it impacts the livelihood of a large number of employees and their families. And to what Representative Ward was asking, I'll give you one example. Meeker County alone, the felony agent left the county and works for the state. If he goes back to the county, his medical copays go from $30 to $62, and he has a $4,000 deductible. These are not unequal playing fields, especially with the small counties. Employees get similar fringe benefits, and I understand that's in the amendment. Fringe benefits are taxable benefits. They're generally more small and not as critical as the salary and health care. But even the biggest concern, Mr. Chair, the CPO counties, unlike CCA counties, are not required to offer the current state employees who are trained and do a very good job a job. That's not what the amendment does. Frankly, it doesn't make any sense not to be doing that, and this creates what would be unemployment, layoffs, and difficult situations for those families in those districts and counties. Excuse me. So where are the savings for these counties? These counties, there's lack of all regulations over the fees that are charged. Counties can charge an offender $50 to transfer from one county to another, for example, or 60 or 30 or whatever it is. When DOC charges, that goes into the general fund. The counties keep their money. So they have tons of fees. There's absolutely very little, if any, regulation over those fees. It creates an imbalance in funding. And they also get the opportunity, even in the amendment, Mr. Chair, to pay reduced wages and benefits for an ability not to hire qualified employees to do this work. That amendment talks about layoff rights. Those layoff rights that are in the first paragraph of the amendment are already afforded to them under their state contract. The second section, for example, is pretty minimal at best. So, Mr. Chair, members, I urge you not to support this. This bill needs some work still before it's ready for what we call prime time here. But there's some real concerns about over jobs and job security for people who are already highly trained in doing this work around the state. Thank you.
Okay. Any other testimony? Commissioner Roy. You want to say something? If you introduce yourself again and go ahead.
Mike McMillan, Director of Wright County Court Services. Chairman Cornish, if I just make a couple points. Currently, the amendment was designed to mirror the CCA amendment, so if a CPO county chose to go CCA, the felony agents would be able to slide into the county system, so that would be, I mean, that's the intent of the amendment, and that would happen today, so the county would have control over those employees that would be coming from the Department of Corrections into a CCA county, and that's what this amendment would, was the intent of that amendment. He chose Meeker County and Wright County. There's benefit. The benefit difference is, I think, different in all 87 counties. So I don't know if you can draw a parallel to what would happen in all counties to Meeker County, to be quite honest. And as far as wages go under the CPO reimbursement, by statute, wages are to be paid commensurate to DOC beginning salary. And my analysis of our wages in CPO counties is that they hold right in line with the Department of Corrections. And in some counties like mine, they're actually higher. Thank you.
Okay, Representative, or excuse me, Commissioner Roy. Maybe a representative someday, but. We probably wouldn't want to trade jobs to either one of us. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections for the state of Minnesota. Seated to my right, Ron Solheid, Deputy Commissioner of Corrections in charge of community services, which basically is probation and parole. And Mr. Solheid is basically the manager of these considerations within the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections has been familiar with this proposal for formally with this language for less than a week. I usually pride myself on appearing in front of this committee totally prepared and totally knowing what I'm talking about. And I have to admit, on this particular proposal, there are elements that I cannot speak to with any great certainty, and that is my concern. We have about 160 state employees providing felony services in these counties. 267 staff. Basically, this proposal would give those current counties, and particularly the courts, an option of choosing what service delivery that they would have in those counties. It definitely has some personnel issues with us. We have long-standing staff providing services in those counties whose lives are in those communities. They live there, their children go to school in those communities, they participate in those communities. They get their paycheck from the state of Minnesota. The future and for those folks becomes very uncertain with this proposal. The future for anybody, I guess, is uncertain, but the robustness of the process where this change would happen is not firmly established in this proposal. When a county chooses to go to community corrections, they have to submit a plan. That plan is fully vetted. There are all kinds of requirements to go under the community corrections model that doesn't exist with this proposal. It actually, if I was to summarize it, I would say that this creates a fourth model of service delivery in the state of Minnesota. And I know, Mr. Chair, you have talked over the years about your concern about the three delivery systems. I think this probably throws a bit more of a concern on your table. I'm not dismissing this relationship that we have in the counties that currently exist. They certainly have programs that we take advantage of. It is a symbiotic relationship that has worked for many, many, many years, decades. And I'm kind of a believer that if it isn't broken, don't fix it. And you should be looking at me with a question mark saying, well, Commissioner, what are you proposing? And today, with Mr. Solheid, I am proposing that we delay any consideration on this proposal and that you allow us to prepare a feasibility study or a study of potential alternatives and clearly how this would impact financially and on the personnel. And I don't anticipate that this would be a very complicated exercise since we have a lot of this information already. And I know legislators sometimes look at department heads and say, when all else fails, ask for a study. But sincerely, on this particular topic, I think a study is warranted, and I think you need the best information possible to make a decision.
Okay, we have Representative Schoen, followed by Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've authored the legislation related to try at least get the discussion going around the three system funding formula that's kind of got this education or the how we do the education funding, which I don't understand either, but that's a completely different committee. But I, this doesn't seem like it's pushing us in the right direction. I mean, I'm not going to be supporting this bill today. I'm not saying that it's the wrong direction at some point in time, but this isn't solving the overarching issue that we need to deal with. As far as I know, the counties I represent, that maybe they would like to do this just because they want to push the needle down or push the needle forward, but we're probably going to have to really, and yeah, I think you've hit on this before too, Chair Cornish, that whole funding mechanism is, in general, we probably really need to talk more about coming into next session and figuring out exactly what it's going to be and maybe hold meetings specifically on that versus trying to do this. So I'm sorry, Representative Johnson, today I can't support you.
Representative Considine is next, but it's the Chair's intention to move this bill to the floor and maybe we can work out the problems in between here and there. But we've been talking about things like this since Representative Paymar and Representative Hillstrom were with no progress, so we're going to move the penny ahead a little bit on the floor. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Chair Cornish. Like the bill that we heard.
Jerry. Representative Hertaus was. Go ahead, Representative Hertaus, and then we'll go back to Representative Considine. I got two lists going here, so it's hard to keep track here.
Well, at least you're not dyslexic, you know. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know that the bill necessarily addresses this, but I enjoyed very much hearing the testimony from Wright County and the responsibilities that counties are willing to take on. Last year, we addressed an issue in which supervised release is not and has not been in the past necessarily a seamless one, which resulted in the unnecessary death of an individual, which we passed a law last year called Colton's Law. And to the extent that we can expand supervised release and make it more seamless, I ran into a lot of issues in trying to get that legislation passed in terms of how these different agencies work with each other and to coordinate the services that are necessary. And so to that end, I hope that this would move us in that direction. I understand what Representative Schoen is saying, and certainly there's seems to be a little bit of concern about jobs and turf and who does what, and I hope we can rise above that and make sure that the services that we're delivering is a seamless one, and in many cases with regard to the offender, it oftentimes means maybe a little bit closer management, close to where they offend and where they're incarcerated and the supervision that they get. Thank you.
Representative Cruz, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, like the bill we heard last week, it doesn't seem like it's well thought out as far as what's going to happen to the employees and how their jobs are going to be affected. So I can't really support it until we address those issues. And I guess I would hope that nobody else would either until we know how exactly it's going to affect the employees. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a question for Mr. McMillan, if he's still here. He's from Wright County and all. So in this discussion, we were talking about the burden on the counties. Has this gone through the county board, and what's the reaction from our county commissioners about adding this to the budget if we do that here in Wright County?
There would be no adding to the budget, and I've talked to them individually, but not as a county board resolution of any means at this point.
Mr. Chair,
because again, it's a May, and they have that choice to do that if they choose to moving forward.
Just a quick follow-up.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. But if they choose to move forward, then the county would pick up the cost of those employees. And I guess that was really the question. If they choose to move forward to make it easier for us to do, like you said, drug court in Wright County, have the county commissioners discussed what it would you know, picking up this additional cost? And how many employees are we talking about in Wright County?
So, okay, so it's Chairman Cornish, Representative O'Neill. I'm going to give you the simple answer. So right now there would be no cost to doing anything that we're talking about. So we're currently doing these services in Wright County without any extra dollars from anybody. Drug court, you know, the federal grant we're applying for, we hope we get it. If we don't, we're going to be able to absorb that probably within our system today from the analysis that we've done. So we're not looking at any cost shifting as far as Wright County is concerned. If, and it's a big if, and that's not what we're looking at. I just want to make that real clear. I've told the commissioner that and everybody else. We're not looking at a complete shift. I'm not saying what other counties would do. But if there was a shift in, to make that shift, the county board would have to make that decision formally through the county board process. So this isn't forcing anybody to do anything. It's just giving them an alternative if they would choose to do that. And we'd be giving our department, a department like mine, the flexibility to provide some felony services, as we're doing today, at no extra cost to the county, for pretrial services, bail studies, et cetera, for those felony offenders. So I'm not looking at it as a cost of anything for our county. And if we did choose to go full boat, the board would have to vote on that.
Sure. Just a quick follow-up, just to one more clarification. So the commissioner came forward and said that there are 267 current DOC employees that are doing this work across the state. And do you happen to know how many of those state employees are doing this work in Wright County?
I believe it's seven.
Seven. Yeah. Okay. Because I'm just trying to get my mind around, because I know what the budgets are in Wright County, and mm-hmm. So you know, if we did a full shift of these seven from the state to the county, you know, it's not enough. It would be something.
Sure, it would be significant, Representative O'Neill, Chairman Cornish. It would be significant if that shift would be made. We're not looking at that shift today in Wright County. They're providing felony supervision and pre-sentence investigations to the court. There's ancillary services that are being done today by our department, because that's where the court wishes them to be done. That would continue. It would clean up, though, some of the variables. The May would clean up things like we're doing felony DWIs, because our county attorney, our bench, we were doing them before the law changed. They wanted us to continue to do them. We had a relationship with the DOC to do that. But it would clean stuff like that up that just kind of sits out there today.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Johnson, or to anybody else, sort of following up on what Representative O'Neill is talking about, if we do this shift, how can we be assured that when counties or somebody's not going to come back to the legislature and ask for money?
Representative Johnson, or who's taking that one?
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I said earlier, the future is unknown, and those counties certainly could make their internal decisions about future contracts, about future layoffs. The state certainly has greater protection for state workers because of the number of locations we do business, the number of potential transfer sites, and the quality of life for a state employee. Some people have chosen because of those future considerations, but clearly the control goes back to those counties, and I make no bones about it. I'm concerned about those employees.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Johnson. In light of the last two testifiers, I hope you will work with them on language that is more acceptable that we can then take up on the floor.
I would be glad to work, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal. I'd be glad to work with them on some of their concerns. But talking to these people and with the budgets now, every biennium, all these groups come to do their budgets. And generally they don't get their full requests. So the counties are making up the differences now.
This bill does not suggest that they're going to, all of them are going to move to a different program. Or in my county, where I worked for 27 years, we have the CPO and the DOC. They work well together. They help each other out. The main reason for this bill is because we're getting into these specialty courts, DWI courts and drug courts. In the drug courts, a lot of time it's felony convictions. A lot of times it's not. It streamlines the process so the right individuals can do the right work. Instead of having 14 different court officers working that program, they can narrow it down to two or three that really understand the program and can really help these individuals. But right now the current law is, it's so gray and it clears it up. The CPOs cannot do felony, but there's the CPOs are doing most of the, in greater Minnesota, in the CPO counties, they're the ones doing the drug courts and the DWI courts. This way it allows them, so if the counties choose, they can continue doing that and doing it statutorily, legally. Right now they cannot.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I think what you're trying to do is great, but I think in the bill's current form, I cannot support it at this time.
Okay, any other testimony, anybody? Any other questions? One of the commissioners?
Mr. Chair, if I could, Ron Solheid, Deputy Commissioner, Community Services Division, and I think one of my concerns gets to what Representative O'Neill asked about, what is the impact in shifting staff, and there is some potential for impact. As example, if one county chooses to participate in this and adds staff, the way the current funding works for the county probation office is it's a reimbursement formula, and the number of staff that are in that pool or that roster impacts the percentage of reimbursement of every county that's included in the county probation. And actually it's all 54 offices, the contract counties and the county probation offices. So those that choose not to participate could potentially have some impact on the funding, the percentage of reimbursement that they're receiving. So there are some concerns on that funding model that this may impact.
Okay. Any other testimony? Okay, Representative Johnson, any quick closing remarks?
Mr. Chair, members, this is an issue that we've all talked about for years, and I think we need to start moving forward and doing some of this stuff so we get some of the issues resolved. So I would renew my motion to recommend House File 3546 to be moved to the General Register.
As amended.
As amended.
Okay, you folks have heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, motion carries. Thank you, Representative Johnson. And we're adjourned.